Weibo and welcome to another episode of Take It Black, a special NAIDOC week episode. And I'm talking with living legend, Uncle Archie Roach. Arch, welcome. And it's great to have you a part of this podcast.
Thank you, Jack. Thanks for having me.
Now, you've been busy last, what, 6 months, 8 months?
We have been busy, strangely enough, in these times, lockdown and COVID.
How have you found the lockdown?
You know, I'm pretty fine with, you know, being at home on my own. I have company, my son and daughter-in-law. Jill's around most days.
You're down Western Districts way of Victoria, right?
Southwest feet.
Yep.
So it's been good. I do miss touring, oddly enough, or that interaction they have with, when I'm on stage, the interaction I have with an audience. I have been missing that, but we found other ways to do things with this new technology.
We're going to have a chat about that. I've been pretty inspired and impressed myself from some of the work that you've had coming out in the last 6 months, but, you know, even more recently than that. But look, first, you've been nominated in a few different sort of categories for the ARIAs this year. We've got Best Adult Contemporary Album for Tell Me Why, and fix me up if I get any of this wrong, Best Male Artist, you've been nominated for this year, Best Independent Release. Any that I've missed?
That's it, I think. Yeah, about that.
Just three or four. Yeah. There's some young artists coming up through that were nominated as well. Baker Boy, Briggs, Jess Malboy, Maisha, older artists as well. Frank Yammer got one for an album. But then, yeah, he was in there. And Kid Leroy, who all of the young people that are younger than me keep telling me that I should be listening to. What's it like, at this stage of your career with Tell Me Why getting the acknowledgement? I think it deserves more acknowledgement, but COVID sort of impacted on your ability to tour it around the country.
Yeah.
But the sales were phenomenal.
It's great to be nominated, to be recognised in the ARIAs especially. You know, I remember years ago, you know, the ARIA Awards and being there and all the nominations and the ARIAs that I've actually won through the years. So it's always good to be recognised by the ARIAs, that's for sure.
I like that section of your memoir, the first time you and Auntie Ruby turned up to go to the ARIAs. And on the red carpet, sort of shocked a few of the photographers there.
Yeah, the crowd, you know, they weren't quite sure who was in the car. The car just pulled up, I suppose. It's just a normal reaction for everybody to start screaming, and even though they didn't know who was there, then, you know, two couriers get out, two black fellows get out of the car and on the red carpet, and then sort of went very quiet.
Different sort of scene, the music industry, or a different complexion to the music industry back in the 1990s, would you say?
Yes, definitely was. It's that's why when Charcoal Lane was nominated back then, didn't know what to expect, and I'm not sure if anybody else did as well, but we got Best Indigenous Release and Best New Artist, so I wasn't expecting Best New Artist, but...
Mm.
It was some amazing time, and I wasn't prepared for what was going to happen not long after that, that's for sure.
Yeah, well, I've written a couple of pieces recently around the release of, well, the anniversary of Charcoal Lane and the release in 1990. One of the people that I spoke to for the Rolling Stone article that I did was Linda Bull. And she was there the night at the Melbourne, well, what's now Hamer Hall, I think Melbourne Concert Hall back in the day. And like Paul Kelly has written about in the past, she said that it was one of the most amazing things, the performance where you supported Paul Kelly and the Messengers, one of the most amazing things that she's ever seen, the way that your voice just basically brought everyone to a standstill. Do you remember that night? As with the sort of clarity that the impression that it's made on people like Linda Bull and Paul Kelly, or is it a bit of a more of a wash in your memory?
No, I remember it well because going out there and singing, so the first song I sung was Beautiful Child. I talked a little bit about it. I just said, this is a song about a young man died in police custody in Bree Warrener, yep, in New South Wales. And I sang that song, and there was just dead quiet silence after that, you know. And I thought, oh, well.
Did you think they, like, didn't like it or?
I wasn't sure what to think. I think I didn't like that. And I just thought to myself, I said, well, I hope you like this. Next one, it's about children being taken away from their families. And a song I wrote about myself, being taken away from my family and brought up in the homes and foster homes. And I sang that, and it was pretty quiet after that. And I just thought, well, you know, blow it. You know, if they don't like it, I'll just go. And I started to walk off. Yep. I turned around to begin to walk off, and then somebody started clapping somewhere, and somebody else, and came. It sounded like rain on a tin roof, coming down slowly at first, you know, one drop here, two drops there, three, four, five drops, and just bang, all of a sudden it just erupted. And I just stood there. I remember raising my guitar above my head going, yeah, but they did like it. I walked off thinking, wow, thank goodness for that. But yeah, it was strange. It was really surreal at the time.
Yeah, yeah, that's what Linda said as well. So it's, when you stepped off stage, because you would have got a big surge of adrenaline as well.
Yeah, I did, absolutely.
That was the bit that I was interested in from the memoir and, you know, from accounts of people I spoke to for the article that I was writing. What did you do? Did you end up walking home? Because you had Ruby was at home with tea waiting for you, wasn't she? She had your dinner on the stove or something.
I ended up going backstage and realising that I mistook for a security guard, was had a guitar strap, thought I was about to go on stage. I said, well, he's certainly not security, that's for sure. And, it was Paul Kelly. But I listened to the first couple of songs, and the thing then was, you know, back in those days, nearly every radio station you turned on, there was a Paul Kelly song being played. And, you know, some of his old stuff. I knew the songs. I said, I've heard these songs. So that's Paul Kelly. Yeah, this is his song. I said, yeah. And I walked out. I said, look, I've got to get home. I walked out after that and just got a cab back. Well, did I have a car? No, I had a car. Yeah, I just went back home.
Had dinner at the kitchen table.
Yeah, well, I didn't fancy having dinner at the kiosk there, which is still to this day, it's not all that deadly.
I mentioned the kitchen table because it was, what, a week or a fortnight or something after that, that next minute Paul Kelly and Steve Connolly are up your joint in Reservoir there jamming around the kitchen table with you, Ruby, and the kids.
That's right. It was actually in Thornbury. It was at the family group home. But, yeah, they came around and talking about, you know, doing an album and what songs we had. And we just started singing some old covers, you know, George, you know, country songs, George Jones and all sorts of country songs. And Merle Haggard, you know, those old guys, Charlie Pride. He said, oh, well, you know, have you got any more songs, you know, like Put the Children Away, let us know, and because we'd be interested, my record company would be interested in doing an album. And so how do you feel about that? I said, oh, you have to give me time to think about it, Paul, Steve. Yeah.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but you had reservations about doing the album.
Oh, look, I don't know why I it didn't. I wasn't concerned about that at the time. I was happy. I worked outside the family group home. I worked at an overnight shelter for hostels, for generally homeless guys that didn't have anywhere to live. And a lot of them were my old mates I used to drink with. And so, yeah, I was quite happy in the life that I was living, and songs that I wrote and sang, I was happy doing them in around community, a few other places. I don't know why I was hesitant at first, but yeah, and I said, I remember telling Ruby, I said, look, I don't. And she asked me, I said, what do you reckon, Dad, you know, an album, do an album? I said, nah, I'm not interested. I don't think I'll do it. And that's when that famous expression, you know, put her hands on her hips and looked at me and said, well, it's not all about you, Archie Bunch. Took a while to register what she meant, but I finally understood what she meant. It's people, you know, because, you know, I looked up to people, you know, like footballers like Polly Farmer and Uncle Doug Nichols and Yvonne Goolagong and people you looked up to, and heroes, our heroes, you know. They made it possible for the rest of us to strive, you know, to hopefully achieve things. But also, when they shone, you know, we shone as well.
I think particularly the song, but that performance at Melbourne Concert Hall or whatever it was called back in the day, to me, the issues that you sort of heralded in or you brought to the attention of a broader audience, the Aboriginal experience, like, it's just amazing that 30 years later they are still two of the issues that remain, to my mind, unreconciled in terms of both the national narrative but also a lot of policy, government policy around those two issues. They're still resonating 30 years later.
I agree, Jack. It's still, you know, 30 years later and, you know, the years before then, prior to 30 years ago.
Yeah. Well, deaths in custody this year with the Black Lives Matter global uprisings. What was going through your head when you were watching some of those on whatever it might be, CNN or whatever, you know, those big marches overseas and then here in Australia?
When I was a kid, I remember the civil rights movement in America, when black people marched on Selma and places like that, and how they were treated. And I was quite alarmed as a kid watching this. Black people being attacked by dogs, being hosed down by big, big fire hoses, men, women and children. And I thought, wow, this is terrible. It took me back to those sort of days. And I thought, do we still have to go out there and force and try to get this message across that our lives matter? I mean, you know, why are we still being persecuted?
Yeah.
The way we are. So yeah, that's how I felt. Yeah.
Well, it seemed I had asked myself the question, like going through this again, why hasn't anything changed since the sorts of, you know, that era, as you mentioned, of Selma, you know, 40, 50 years ago now. But I think it's because there is a challenge now to the structures. Whatever, you know, the civil rights movement was before, it wasn't articulated that this we're challenging the structure of things. Yeah. And this time around, it's very definite about we want to see changes in the structure, whether it be policing, education, all of those other institutions.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's true. It just brought me back to that time and I just thought, wow, how long is it going to take? You just scratch your head and think, why? Why should it take this long? And sometimes you get weary, but, you know, you still carry on because of the struggle. Hopefully we will achieve something in freedom through the struggle, freedom from oppression, freedom from mental illness, freedom from physical illness because of things that have happened to us.
Yeah. Well, look, I mentioned education pointedly because you have released Archie Roach's Stolen Generations Education Resource. Pretty sure that dropped last week. That involves some film conversations you've had with other elders around the place. Uncle Jack Charles, for example, he's in there. Auntie Lorraine Peters. Auntie Emma Jo Edwards. Yeah. Must be Muddy Muddy, surely related to Chris up there. Sid Jackson, champion. And Auntie Iris Byseth, I don't know, but Barkindji woman. Now, can you tell us a bit about the objective of this education resource?
Well, the objective, I suppose, is to hopefully get it on the curriculum into schools, you know, with teachers and school children to be able to access this and, you know, get a better understanding of Stolen Generation and what that is and who that is and what we're talking about and how we're healing, you know, speaking our truth, healing.
Transgenerational impacts.
That's right. The true history about the full history of this country. You can't sweep it under the carpet. It's the history of this country, and it needs to be ignored. And people need to understand that. Not just our own people, First Nation people, but you know, others, they need to own it and realise it, yeah, and say, well, you know, this took place. This is not just, you know, First Nations history, but it's our history as well, because it's Australian history. That's the main objective, is to get it there. So,
well, I think it needs to go in, because I'm a bit younger than you. I went through school in the 80s, early 90s.
Yeah,
there was nothing in, you know, what we were being taught at that point. There's an argument I see come up on social media when, you know, so NITV, when we posted this yarn that we did on the resource last week, I've seen some reactions like, oh, well, you know, we get taught that in schools now or whatever. But that's kind of beside the point, because it's people my age that are moving into positions of power, whether it's government or running companies or whatever, you know, people in the late 30s, early 40s. And we weren't taught, you know, as a cohort, there was none of that part of our education. So the blackfellas that I went through school with, of course, we knew about kids being taken, fear of welfare. You know, we couldn't articulate it to the point that we could today, but we certainly knew, and our parents were always concerned about welfare coming around and picking us up if we've been running amok. But it's not that far, you know, in the past. And I think people forget that. Do you get that sense when you're going around, you know, telling these stories over and over, that people tend to forget that it's such a recent sort of phenomenon?
It's true. There's a lot of people that I see that come up and talk to me. They're sort of like already, so that, you know, they're fans or that. They weren't taught this in school, and they didn't know anything about it until they first took the children away and other songs dealing with that. But it's true. You know, people tend to forget it wasn't that long ago when it happened, and what is still happening. And
yeah, well, that's right. It's still happening now.
Well, children, you know, and out of home care. It's I want to read the stats on that. It's it sort of blows your mind. It's just as horrific. Take it black.
Now, around the education resource, or even a part of it, I suppose, the release of Took the Children Away, the book, the picture book, illustrated by Arnie Ruby, lyrics of the song in there. How has that been received?
Oh, very, very well. It's a beautiful book, but, you know, with the illustrations by Rube. In the back, there's some more information and some archival footage, things that the welfare wrote, you know, so they can, people get an understanding of, you know, how our lives were decided by complete strangers and where we should go and what we should do. So it's a great book, and I'm glad it's been received the way it has. A lot of people have been asking for it, yeah.
Yeah, I received a copy in the mail, and, you know, as you do with mail, opened up, left it on the kitchen table and went off to do something else. When I come back, my four-year-old boy was looking through it. He loved it. And that's, I was just thinking, you know, watching him, you know, leafing through it, is it too heavy for kids of that age? My young fella, no, because obviously he is across a lot of the stuff that I have to deal with in my job. But for other kids, and I think, you know, the boy answered it himself. They gravitate towards these sorts of stories, these stories that are full of heart and weight and importance. You know, they get it. They're not stupid. So worthwhile pointing that out, because, again, I've seen some people, you know, raising that, is it too much to put on kids? And the answer is no.
No, no, I don't think so. And you're trying to present it in a way that the book does, you know, more in a gentler way. But, you know, I myself have received mail. I've got mail from children before the book was even out, you know, from a couple of years ago, where teachers have taught them about, you know, played my song and taught them about the stolen generations. And they've written me letters and saying how sorry they were and couldn't understand why it should happen and feeling hurt that it happened. And so, yeah, like you said, children, they're not silly. And they understand, you know, things. And if we try to keep stuff from them because it might be a bit too sensitive for them or a bit too harsh, would be the wrong thing, I think, to do.
Well, they pick up on it, don't they?
Yeah, it'd be letting them down in a way, I believe, you know, so they can grow up with this and fully know what it was all about. And hopefully that's the beginning. Like the book took the children away, the picture book, and later on they can access other information from the myriad of sources that are around, the resources. That way they're going to ensure it never happens again.
Yeah, well, that's the first stepping stone on the truth-telling process, sure.
Yeah, that's true.
And the second step is young adults. There's also been a version of your memoir, Tell Me Why, that's released for young adults. Comes out March.
In March, yeah.
Right. I've got that one penciled in. I'll be getting that as well. But what I wanted to sort of get across today, and something that's blown my mind in the last, you know, observing for the last whatever it is, feels like, you know, an endless loop in terms of being locked down. But whenever we went into lockdown, you've become a YouTube internet sensation. Did you ever in your wildest dreams suspect that at any stage in your career that you'd become a YouTube sensation?
Never, Jack. In fact, when Jill first approached me about it, my manager, Jill, I just thought, oh, I don't know about this. I was a bit nervous at first, but now it's something I look forward to doing each YouTube episode and talking about, celebrating 30 years of Tarka Wayne, the album.
Yeah. What is it for listeners that perhaps haven't seen it? And if you haven't, just go onto YouTube and search for Archie Roach. But give us a visual. What are we looking at when we're tuning into the Archie Channel?
We start talking about the songs and the inspiration behind the songs and what the song was actually about. And talk about it like I know when Ruby first came to Charcoal Lane, and because it was just men just used to go there. Only men just used to drink down there. I don't know if that was a rule or anything, but women just never seemed to come down to Charcoal Lane at the time, except when Ruby came down first.
Just on that point, I spent time living in Fitzroy, Collingwood. Where was Charcoal Lane? Was it? It's not the same one that people think it is it?
It's not up near where they've got the restaurant.
Mm.
It's down further. It's across Smith Street, actually in the Collingwood area. And the only way to explain it's off a street, little street called Derby Street, just off Smith Street. The best way to put it is it used to be behind the Cambridge Street School, primary school. It's been turned into a car park and it's not there anymore, the lane.
Yeah, right.
Unfortunately, and that's where it originally was, on the Collingwood side of Smith Street. Yeah.
Because you were a Collingwood boy at that time, weren't you? Or around?
We first lived in Collingwood. We didn't hang around Collingwood all the way except for Charcoal Lane, which was basically
up Fitzroy.
Fitzroy, really.
Yeah. When you go down Gertrude Street now, what sorts of things are passing through your mind?
Oh, ghosts. Ghosts, it's like it's haunted. In the haunted hills, I see ghosts of old fellas. Fellas I used to drink with and fellas I used to know and fellas used to hang around the pubs and old fellas, each pub, the top pub, the champion, there's often Uncle Banjo, who used to, not Uncle Banjo Clark, another Uncle Banjo, who used to pick up all the glasses and they sling him a few dollars for doing that. And down the bottom at the Builder's Arms, there was another old fellow by the name of Uncle Chico, Savage. And he did the same thing, picking up all the glasses, empty glasses. Because it's different now. It's not like it used to be. You know, you see a couple of stragglers here and there, but not like it used to be. You used to walk down Gertrude Street. If you're going from one pub or going from one place to the other down Gertrude Street, it'd take you about an hour to get there because community would stop you in the street. And when community was strong and aunties, uncles, cousins, and you'd be having a yarn, you know. And next minute you get up and start going, where was I going again?
Another one singing out.
But that's what I see. You know, it's like, yeah, I see old faces. You know, it's like you're going into the Haunted Hills, you know. Mm. See ghosts of all the old fellas, you know.
Yeah, I went down there one night with Gary Foley. We're going to some art exhibition there opposite the Builder's Arms, and we got out of the Uber or whatever we caught there. He was telling me that the Builder's Arms were the reason he arrived in Melbourne, and it was the reason why he stayed. He got out of the whatever, the taxi, you know, back in whenever he arrived all those decades ago, and he went in, had a beer, and went, I'm home. I'm stopping here. So it must have been a pretty welcoming environment, you know, amongst a racist society still back in, you know, late 60s, 70s, whenever you locked here. Yeah. But it must have been a pretty welcoming and safe spot.
Yeah, it was. It was, you felt comfortable. Everybody was there. Our jukebox would be going. Hmm. Yeah, I had most of my family there in the pubs and the hotels in Gertrude Street. So, yeah, it was a time when community was that strong, it was that deadly, that, yeah, we need to get that back somehow, you know, because a lot of young fellas aren't growing up with that type of community experience and strength that I had, even though I was drinking. Mm. But, you know, community kept you, I know, safe. It just kept you, yeah.
Well, there's a bit of that online, and that sort of gives me some hope, particularly around if they all go and start checking out the YouTube channel. But again, you miss out on that the physical side of it, don't you? Being able to pull someone in line when they're going off about something silly, or you know, you know, you need that aspect, that tangible element to it. Charcoal Lane Kitchen Sessions series is sort of drawing to an end, but you've got another one coming. Is that right? You've got Yarn with Uncle?
Yeah, hopefully we'll have we're going to talk to young up-and-comers, I suppose, singer-songwriters.
Oh, yeah, yep.
So talking to them, conversation with them, and talking about their songs and songwriting and what their inspiration is also behind their music. And so,
yeah, I caught up with Leah Flanagan the other day for Take It Black. And, yeah, she's working with got a number of roles, but one of them is working with the young ones coming through. She just said there's so many. There's so many, and they all need sort of mentoring, and they're all, you know, hungry for mentoring as much as they can get. So it was a great initiative. Also, as part of the Charcoal Lane Kitchen Table YouTube sessions, you ended up recording Charcoal Lane again.
Yeah, the songs of Charcoal Lane. Just here where I'm talking to you now from Jack.
Yep.
My kitchen table. And I had two other musicians, Steve Magnuson on guitar and a fellow called Sam Anning on double bass. It was just so different than going to a studio, you know, doing it, you know, doing a couple of hours in the studio, I mean, because it was relaxed here at home. I could see outside my window in the back there. Mm-hmm. It just felt so comfortable doing it that way, and I think that the album, the songs show that. It's like 30 years since I recorded those songs, and it's now it's like they've grown as I've grown through the years. The songs, I sing them, I suppose, interpret them the way I suppose they should have been, but they were so fresh and new when I first recorded them. It needed that time, I suppose, for them to grow and mature along with myself, to actually understand how to interpret them. So
that album drops NAIDOC week.
Yeah, NAIDOC week, but we've already
got the single out.
The single, Took the Children Away, and a clip as well.
Okay. I've heard the single, I haven't seen the clip. Where can I find the clip?
Well, it's on YouTube. People actually went out to Framingham, Aboriginal, where the people still live there.
Yep.
And did some of the clip there and some footage from the time it was up in Bunjalung country, my father's country, Lawrence Hill and the Clarence River. So it's having them both together. It's a great group, you know, but Gunnish Mahakati, my mother's country, is represented by the West Hale Eagle. My father's country, Bunjalung country, is represented by his spirit. Being red-bellied back snake, so very, very happy with and proud of what we've been able to do, and Jill Sharpton has been able to do.
Well, the single, it's really intimate, and Took the Children Away Can Be Any More Moving. It manages to find where it can go to make it, you know, more moving. So, yeah, well done. I'd recommend listeners get out and get that album as soon as it drops. Speaking of Bunjalung country, I wanted to take the opportunity while speaking to you to put a call out there. Shout out to Kathy Cumsey, who I believe is your cousin. Amazing woman. For listeners that don't know Kathy, she was, I'm hoping to get her on to take it back at some point to talk about her work with Streetwise, which was one of the first comic books, Aboriginal comic books, put out in Australia. And she was instrumental, I think, or, you know, one of the organisers for the Bicentennial March back in 1988, which you went up to. That's part of your memoir I read there. How was that? Like, talking about BLM, marches and demonstrations before, I was there in 1988, but I was only a young fella. But how was it, you know, heading up there?
It was a time where you just felt invincible. It felt like we'd arrived. We're going to do so many great things. Unfortunately, it didn't work out like that. But during that time, you just felt that. You felt that empowerment with so many people from all around the country. Aboriginal, Torres Strait Islander people, just their one mind and one voice. It was so powerful, Jack, so powerful. I'm glad my sons, they were just little at the time, had the chance to be there as well to see it.
It was the biggest demonstration that I'd ever seen. Of course it was, I think I was 11 or 12 or something, but to me, to think back to then, 40,000 or 50,000, whatever the estimate of the crowd size was, but now we get to see that pretty much every year in multiple cities on the same day, let alone, you know, around BLM stuff. What do you feel when you see the vision of these crowds on January 26 and stuff come together to sort of demand acknowledgement and address for redress of the same sorts of issues that, you know, marching for in 1988.
I know, I feel that, you know, at least that people are still there and want our voices to be heard, even though we have to still talk about it. If that's the case, then yeah, we should front up, you know, whenever we can, and just keep, you know, keep up the struggle. Anyway, nothing is going to be achieved if we sit in our mums and just hope and write to government and write to our, whoever in government, and hopefully wait for them to do something. We've got to get up and try to push for change through demonstration. And that's the way we've done it. That's the way we did it. And our young people are doing the same thing. Take it black.
So I'm here with living legend, Uncle Archie Roach. Just before we go, we're out of time again. I could be just talking with you for months. I'd like to. What do you got coming? I know the new album, The Songs of Charcoal Lane, dropping in NAIDOC week. Any albums after that you can give me the exclusive of?
Well, yeah, we have an album of songs that I've written already before, but never made it onto albums.
Yep.
So we're going to release them called the Old Days.
Oh, cool.
In January, we're hopefully going to release those songs. And, listening to back to them again, I thought, wow, when you hear them and think that these are good songs, you know, if you actually like the songs yourself of what you've written and done, chances are other people will too. So hopefully we'll get that out in January. Yeah.
Well, next month you're going to be on the cover of the Rolling Stone magazine, right in the centre too. one of the 50th all-time greatest Australian artists. I think I've got that right. Did you ever think that you were going to get on the cover of Rolling Stone magazine? I mean, they've had a number of articles about you, but there you are, right in the front and centre.
No, used to sing along with Dr. Hook, you know, cover of Rolling Stone. And but, you know, you don't think about stuff like that. You know, even albums, you know, you don't think about, oh, Dizzy Dilly is going to, you know, get an ARIA award or going to go gold. You just hope that somebody likes it. But it's a great acknowledgement. And to see yourself on the cover of Rolling Stone like it is now, with that red bean on my stick out like a sore thumb.
Yeah, they made sure that you were right there.
Been down, you know, back fell on me. So
well, that's the other thing.
I just go straight to me, even though I didn't want. I was trying to see who else is here, and I kept looking straight at me. I said, look, and that's the way it is with it. And I'm glad and happy that I did.
So our listeners should get out and buy this month's edition with my story in there on Archie. Did you know that there was an element in my story, just spruik my story again for a second, where the fella that come out and spoke to you about your album, Charcoal Lane, 30 years ago, ended up being the grandson of Sidney Nolan. Did you know that at the time?
No. I mean, I'd only found that out just recently, that he's Sidney Nolan's grandson.
Yeah. And he was saying to me, I chased him down and he told me that it was Sidney Nolan's paintings that he did on Death in Custody that, you know, tuned his ear to the cause. Mm. So, yeah, it was just an amazing sort of thing that emerged doing that story. Look, unfortunately, we are out of time. Thank you very much for joining us for this special NAIDOC episode of Take It Black.
No, thank you, Jack, for having me. It was a great yarn, but
we'll have to have another chat when the next album in January comes out.
Yeah, that'd be good. Always love, always coming.
Well, thank you, Archie Roach, for joining me for this special NAIDOC Week episode of Take It Black. Listeners, you can subscribe to Archie's YouTube channel. Just go to the YouTube website, tap in Archie into the search field and hit the big red subscribe button. You can also pre-order the Songs of Charcoal Lane, the new album, by going to Archie's website, archieroach.com/store. All proceeds of the sales go to the Archie Roach Foundation. Now, while you got your tapping fingers out and hitting your smart device, you should also subscribe to Take It Black. Do that through your preferred podcast listening app. And why not throw us a follow at Twitter while you're there? So from all of us at NITV News Online, happy NAIDOC Week. Always was, always will be. Stay fierce and keep taking it black.